sincerely Reese, and this is my podcast. I would have started sooner, but I was sitting on my ass. No, I'm just playing. I'm hella productive, but not in ways everyone finds constructive. Content? I don't know. My real plan is just to go with the flow, you know, and tell my truth about my family, making music, self-care, and who I strive to be. Some people say, you don't talk. That's not true. The truth is, I just don't talk to you. So antisocial? Not really me. I'm just selective with whom I exchange energy. This here is my journey, no longer misunderstood. Welcome to my podcast, kinda hippie, kinda hood. What's up?
Oh my gosh, if you could see how clammy my hands are and how sweaty the screen is.
I'm dying.
From stress and realizing I'm not a millennial after all and I can't figure these things out. Oh my God.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I was dying.
No, I really feel like my mom.
I was like, well, this makes sense anyway. Like, right. It has to be hectic.
Wow. But we made it and here we are.
Listen. We did. Well, welcome to Kind of Hippie Behind the Hood.
Thank you for having me, Siri. I'm so happy to be here.
So for our listeners, today I'm having my very good friend, Claudia Eliza Zanes, as my co-host. Welcome, Claudia.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
So we've been friends for like 20 years.
Yeah, don't say that out loud. I don't think that's...
It's a little TMI.
I know what people are thinking.
So we've been friends for 5 minutes.
Right, exactly. Because they're looking at us, Siri, because they're seeing our photos, and then they're saying, but wait, they can't be a day over 20 years old. So how are they friends?
It's true. Like most people, like when I meet new people, they think I'm in my 20s, and I really appreciate it.
You have to claim that blackage don't crackage, you know, that thing.
It's not.
So
we've been friends for a minute, and I would love to start our conversation by you telling our listeners about your journey as a musician, like when you started playing and writing music and the whole shebang.
Ooh, okay. All right. I'm going to try to like, you know, cliff notes. Okay.
A little condensed. Right.
We're going to condense this. Okay. So I really got my start in music. I never remember a time in my life where music wasn't a part of it. Truly, music has been the oxygen that I've breathed since, my gosh, day one, really, because my parents listened to a lot of records. We had a lot of Haitian music playing in the house when I was growing up. And I was also raised in a Baptist church where every Sunday we were singing. It was children's choir. It was, and then again, teen choir and then adult choir. So I was singing really from a very, very young age. And I'm really grateful because I'm grateful that I don't remember this period of when I started to sing. It just seemed like such a natural,
right?
Yeah, such a natural thing that was a part of my household. And I'm really grateful for the music I was exposed to. But then, of course, that went on to school, singing in school. This is when music was really a part of the curriculum, too. So I didn't have music every day, but like, you know, we definitely were killing the recorders. We were playing hot cross buns. We were doing stuff like that. And we were also, we had, I think it was like once a week, we had this teacher who would come in and teach songs to us. And I also very vividly remember my second grade teacher third grade teacher singing songs to us in the classroom. So that was also just a part of the curriculum. And that was something I'm really grateful for too, because I don't think that happens a lot where teachers are singing with their kids, like teachers, not a music teacher, a teacher. Right. So I totally agree. Exactly. So that was kind of the start. I was then, like I said, introduced to instruments in the fourth grade. I picked up the flute, played that for a couple of years, only because it was a small enough instrument that could fit in my backpack. That really was the inspiration.
Wait, now I don't want to lug it.
You know that's why you picked up clarinet too, Siri. So.
But wait, then it went to Barry Sachs for me. So like...
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
I I did that for a while. And then eventually in, you know, my teacher, my band director, I guess there was a shortage in brass instruments, like, you know, the trombone in particular. So she had asked anyone who would be willing to pick up the trombone, she was going to provide them with a trombone to use for the summer. And because my parents couldn't afford to buy me a trombone at that time, it was perfect because I had this trombone to borrow and I got to learn how to play the instrument. And then I really kind of fell in love with the sound, and it was just a visual. I wasn't used to seeing a woman on the trombone, you know? And right. So that was kind of hip to hold it down with the guys in the brass section on trombone for a couple of years. And so that was kind of my introduction.
We got to pause. That is exactly how I ended up playing Barry sax. So what had happened was was obsessed with Kenny G. And so it was nonstop requests of, yo, mom, can I have a soprano sax? Can I have a soprano sax? And she's like, no, we just got this clarinet. We just got this piano. We've already got some drums. She's like, absolutely not. So I went to my high school band director and I was like, do we have a soprano sax? And he's like, no, but we have a Barry sax. And if you want, you can take that home over the summer, learn to play it. And then in the fall, you can play in jazz band.
Oh, that's an amazing deal, though.
A fantastic deal. Like, I was completely hooked up. Now, granted, the size was not even close into like opposite end of the saxophone spectrum.
Oh my! And what grade is this? How old are you at this time?
Man, at this time, I was a freshman in high school. Oh. I didn't pick up saxophone until ninth grade.
Wow.
Yep. So I just did clarinet and percussion through elementary school and junior high. And then in ninth grade, I was like, oh, snap, I can totally do soprano sax. And mom was like, absolutely not.
Hey, that is amazing.
So I love that how you got the trombone. So go ahead. So trombone, you were in love with it.
So trombone, fell in love with the trombone, played that for a couple of years. It was actually a little bit challenging too, which was good for me. You know, I was so used to reading in treble clef, so now we're transitioning to bass clef.
Right.
So that was some new ripples in the brain being made. And that was a lot of fun though. You know what I mean? It was just I was thinking harder. It was a real big challenge for me. And then there's the whole thing with embouchure, moving from a flute, like, you know,
yes,
to the trombone. So there was a lot of things there. My parents were very supportive. Again, music, they loved music and they supported the arts fully. Praise God for them.
That's so fantastic.
Yes. Yes. I realize how, you know, that can be a rarity in many households. So I'm grateful for that. And then I moved. My family moved so I was born in New Hampshire, and that's where I was introduced to these instruments. And then we later moved to California, to Northern California.
And so how old were you then?
I was 14 going on 15.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So I started high school out there, and that was really my first time joining like a choir in school. Like, I'd had choir in junior high and all that, but for whatever reason, I wasn't a part of that. But being in high school now, I'd heard jazz music. I had, again, like, I was never exposed to jazz music growing up, but seeing this jazz choir, it was a group of maybe comprised of like 12 people, but it blew my mind. Like, I heard them singing, and I remember hearing scat singing for the very first time, and I didn't know what was happening. I really thought that like everyone forgot the words and was just making That's how developed my vocabulary was. So yeah, so I really didn't know what was going on. I just was like, what is happening? And what are these syllables? And like, what are these sounds? Like, why are they doing this? It made absolutely no sense to me. But then I started, you know, I was inquisitive and curious and I wanted to know more. So I started to do research. I started looking up some of the jazz greats and I started listening to people like Ella Fitzgerald and Chet Baker and who else? My gosh, like the greats, you know, Sarah Vaughan.
Yeah, Sarah Vaughan, right.
And I'm listening to these ladies sing, and there was just, honestly, like, I really don't think I chose jazz music. I think it was one of those things that just took over me. It chose me, really, essentially, is what happened.
Yep.
It was like I heard it, and I just felt an instant connection. Like, it was like, I felt like I was in the room with Sarah, like Sarah's singing to me, wherever, whatever well she's pulling from, like I totally connect to that. And I totally feel where she's coming from. Same with Ella. There was just something in the voice and something in the approach that just, again, resonated with me. And so I then auditioned to be in the jazz choir, got in, and I just love, like, I am a sucker for, like, tight harmonies,
you know,
super juicy harmonies that are stacked on top of each other and dissonance and, like, crazy, crazy closeness. So, so then I got into that, the jazz choir, and that was really exciting for me because it really helped elevate my, well, have a deeper understanding of listening to the music and hearing where your part fits in, because I was so used to just like SATB, like concert choir, you know, soprano, alto,
standard.
Yeah, it's your real standard, but you've got, you know, you got 50 altos, 51 sopranos, you know, so it's like, you know, so it really was a cool thing to be singing in a group that was so much more tight-knit, where you could hear everything and every nuance in folks' voices could be heard. And so I love that. Like, I just loved hearing what every part was doing and how it was moving and how my part connected to that. And then you also, there's a whole different kind of level of responsibility. So I grew as a musician, really, when I
The accountability changes in an ensemble like that.
Because it's easy to hide out with the other flutes, you know, there's like 99 of them. And, you know, we're all playing the same thing. So it's like, if I stand out, you know, if I make a mistake, I'm not standing out, essentially. So this was just like, if you, it's strong and wrong. Like, if you mess up, you know, so it's like... So it was good because it really forced me to practice a lot more. It's not enough to just float by with your natural talent, so to speak, because it's and also I was an alto, which is always, we know the parts are always quite, you know, you know, that's an inside joke Siri and I got, we with a solo.
So extra.
Anyway, but you know what I'm saying? It's like it's a different kind of line that we sing, and it's like you really got to know your part. It's not necessarily the melody. So that really, again, that was a whole different kind of level of responsibility and respect, really learning to respect the music and respect, you know, just your other, the your other musical folks that are in with you. You know, you got to do your part. And so, yeah, we started doing competitions. I got into, you know, we did something at Carnegie Hall, and I really saw like where this could take you. Like, you know, I was kind of like, this is amazing. Like music, I'm doing this and it feels good. It's not forced. It's, it just feels amazing. And jazz was really that first love in that way to really capture me like that. Like gospel did the same thing. In its own way, but jazz also did this in a very special way that took me to places. That, you know, really, music was my passport. Truly, it truly was. It really allowed me to travel and go and see the world outside of my little Novato home in Northern California.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that was the beauty of the arts for me. It truly was a lifesaver. It really came at a time for me where it was. Where I could see life outside of just what was in my sight. And I got to meet other people doing the same thing and had the same sort of love and passion. So you start to kind of make these really strong connections with other people because you share this common language.
Right. So at what point did you realize, hey, I want to do this professionally? Like I want to, after high school, this is what I want to do and this is how I'm going to pursue it.
Wait, can you repeat the question, Siri? Sorry, you cut out just for a second.
At what point did you realize that you wanted to pursue music professionally?
Wow. So I knew, I feel like it was always at my core. I wasn't sure how, okay, this is the answer. So I wasn't, it was always at my core, but I wasn't sure how I was going to pursue it professionally.
Yes. Because, I still don't know sometimes.
You know, sometimes the roadmap changes and it shifts and I really have no clue. And it was one of those things where I feel like, you know, you're in high school and you're taking these tests and you're trying to figure things out. And I had a lot of friends in school that were, you know, getting their acceptance letters into colleges and they're going to go do this and they're going to go study that and they're going to go do this. I didn't necessarily have a ton of friends who pursued a career in music. So
right.
I really didn't see that roadmap. I didn't know what that looked like. I didn't know how I go about this. Like I really had no clue. All of a sudden I knew I'm a senior and things end here. You know, we've come to the end of the road here. It's kind of like, I wasn't really sure of like what was going to happen. Like in my mind, I was thinking, well, I guess I could stay local and go like to the junior college and just kind of take music classes. But that didn't seem like enough to me. That wasn't, right. I wasn't necessarily my passion, but I just think I was going to fall into that path.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like really just not knowing what I should be doing. So, you know, so when the Young Americans organization actually came to my school when I was in high school, and I would have to say truly that that was sort of the light bulb moment for me that there is a whole, that this is possible. Like this, you know, junior college isn't the only way. I mean, I did end up going to a junior college later on while I was in the organization, while I was a part of the organization. But at the same time, it was, you know, seeing these young folks that were close to my age and seeing, seeing how they were using music. I'd never seen that. Like that was something that was so new to me too. You know, these young folks come into my school, wow, they care about us and they're here and they're doing this thing and I get to be a part of it. And, you know, they're rooting me on. It just felt good. You know, you feel like a rock star, you know? And I think that there was a part of me that felt like, okay, well, I auditioned then and there. Like I knew that this could be my ticket out. I knew that. That much I
knew. So pause for 1 second, because I actually have not talked about the Young Americans on the podcast before.
Oh!
So yes, I've been saving it for us, my friend. I have been saving it. So, if you could please share with the class exactly what the Young Americans organization is.
Oh my goodness. Well, you need to do that, please, because, okay.
Cliff Notes, though.
Cliff Notes is pretty much a nonprofit organization that's really, the foundation is young adults. So I'd say, I don't know, what is it, 15 if they're local in Southern California, I think?
Yeah.
So 20, I don't know, some people push the 20 envelope, I think it's 22, I don't know, something like that. There are young folks in Los Angeles. It's a crew of folks who do pretty much the performing arts. So that's singing, that's dancing, that's acting. And so we're a nonprofit, it's a nonprofit organization that's based in Los Angeles that pretty much teaches music and arts to communities around the world now. So they go to schools with like compromised music programs and they'll go and they'll do, you know, they'll put on, you know, they'll do the arts, they'll work with the kids, they'll teach the kids music, they'll teach the kids dance, they'll teach the kids lines, and the kids end up doing a show in their community for the whole, yeah, their whole network, I guess, essentially.
Yeah. That's how we met.
Huh?
And that's how we met in the Young Americans.
Yes, and that's kind of the Young Americans. It's kind of, it's an opportunity. So you're learning a lot. So that's the thing that Young Americans also does, is you don't realize you're learning these things. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is DIY. You know, it's a very, you know, we're the ones building sets, we're the ones counting costumes and
is that still the way? I don't know.
Good question. We're talking, you know, we're aging ourselves again.
20 years ago.
What it was when we were, it could very much be different. We could talk to a new kid now and they'd be like, yeah, absolutely not. We don't know what you're talking about.
But never like, touched a hammer.
Right, never, right? but it taught me, you know, that essentially was my sort of college entry to college life. Like I didn't go to, because this was before it was a school. So this was essentially where I was meeting with other peers. This is where I met you. And you know, and so you meet your kind of, you know, a lot of close friends, you're touring with these people, you're learning numbers with these people, you're doing shows with these people, you're again doing all of the, you know, the lights, the scaffolding, the building the set. So it's a lot of things that we were doing that other kids our age weren't necessarily getting that sort of experience. So a lot of my friends were in college, but this was sort of my college years.
It's so interesting because what I didn't know, I expected, you know, to go on tour and to meet new friends and extra stuff I would learn, like set building and stage managing and costume design. Like those weren't things I even had on my radar to learn, you know?
Right.
And so it was so interesting. And I was coming from Iowa. So when I got out here, it was like fish out of water. Like, I was completely out of my element, totally homesick, like just a hot mess, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I could agree. Like, I feel like, so again, you have to remember, see, the young folks that are going to be listening to this podcast, like, you know, the kids that are in the group today, or just younger folks are going to die, because the way it worked for me, and I guess for you too, because this was our year. So I got a directory in the mail. And yes. I literally remember going through the directory, because it pretty much, again, I live in California at this point. I've been accepted into the group. I need to put together my apartment. I don't know where I'm living once I get to Los Angeles. So, so you know, this is pre-Facebook. This is pre-social media. There's no such thing. So literally all I have is this little thin paperback book that has all these names and phone numbers, home phone. This is not cell phone, right?
Home, full ass phone numbers. Like, I think it was first, last, address, because so you knew where people were from and the phone number.
So like my way of going about it, because I had no idea. I'm just like this, you know, I'm young. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just trying to figure out where I'm going to live. I'm trying to figure out life. And so I have the book, and I remember my best friend was over. My best friend Mike was over, and he was like, okay, well, let's figure out where you're going to live. So we go through the book, and because I don't know how to choose, I just went through and picked people with the coolest names. So that's where I found Charity. That's how I found Charity. And I was like, I guess, let me call her. So then I called Charity. Because how do you know about it? Like, what do you even do? Which is
well,
so
listen.
Hard to think of today, because I'm like, if I had a kid, like,
oh my gosh,
I really don't know if that's gonna work. You know what I mean? Like that kind of method.
Look, so for me, it was a little different because I had friends from my hometown that were moving out. So I had Jed and Steph, who I already knew for several years as my roommate. And Jed knew Michael, so Michael was the only one I didn't really know. But Sally, sorry for people who don't know us, but Sally actually called me when she was looking for a roommate. And I remember being like, what is this accent? Like,
because that's who I, again, you don't know us, sorry, but that's who I ended up living with.
Right. And so when you and I became friends, and I knew there was only going to be one Sally from Wisconsin with this strong accent, and I met her. I died.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yes, I died. I was like, oh, sorry, I've already got roommates, you know, friends from home. Like,
no, it was a totally different day. And sometimes I laugh when I think about it. There's a beauty to that sort of level of innocence and safety in doing that. Like now I could never think of such a thing, but like truly that's how it was done. And it was, and this was the other thing, because Sally to this day still has a picture of me from like senior prom or something. It was old school pal. Like you didn't know who you were going to be with. So it's like, let me just write you a nice little letter.
This is what I look like.
That was the original profile pic, you know?
Oh my gosh.
So yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It was insane, but that was for me, like, you know, it was a way out. That was my sort of way out of what was already happening. There was a lot to learn, truly, like honestly, coming out of a predominantly white community too. For me, it was so important. And what is the word? Just super refreshing to come and to meet you. Like, cause I think that for me, I was, you know, most of my upbringing has been in predominantly white communities, and I haven't necessarily had a lot of folks of color for friends, like beside my family.
Right.
Of course I got cousins, I got buku, you know, I got a lot of cousins, but I mean, as far as friends and meeting people in school, I mean, there might be five of us in my entire like elementary school, something like that, maybe. Mm-hmm. And high school was really not much different. So then to be in this group, and there wasn't a lot, I'm not gonna lie too. It's not like there was a ton in Young Americans, but at the same time, I was so automatically, kind of like I was talking about the jazz music and feeling Sarah Vaughan and these people. It was like you, I was just a magnet to you, because it was like, oh my gosh, someone, I'm represented here, and I have a friend here,
right.
And I have someone who can relate to my experience, and someone I can, a new friend here. And so that was so important to me too. And like, truthfully, I will never forget. Cause I remember I was not about to, you remember we had a lot of conversations when we first made it to the group and we had auditioned for Southern Tour. I did not want to audition for Southern Tour. I was like, there's no
way. Oh my gosh.
I'm not doing it. And you're like, Cleo, I'll do it too. Oh, Cleo's my name. You were wondering, but you know, you're like, I'll do it too. And I was like, I don't know, Sierra. I don't know. And you know, it was scary. You know what I mean? There was in a way, there was no real prep for that. Like, I really had a lot of angst about that. I really had a lot of sort of, you know, my understandings of what this, a lot of these Southern states represented and where they stood on political lines and values. And you know, so I, and just the racial divide and all of that stuff. It was really traumatic for me to think about, let's go down south. Like, I was not,
right.
I was not feeling it at all. But to know that you were going to be there, that Michael Cartwright was going to be there,
right,
some level of comfort. So in a way, I feel like I worked through a lot of that stuff because y'all were there.
I got to say, I co-signed 1,000% because I did not have a Black friend community much to relate to growing up. And at my school, more times than not, it seemed like the Black students were pinned against each other as competition and not so much as teammates. So when I moved to California and I was put in an environment where there were truly only a handful of Black people in the performing arts group we were in, and we met, I felt like, oh shit, I might actually be able to be okay out here.
Yeah.
You know, because it was a completely different coast and lifestyle than I was used to. But for the people who looked like me and understood my background on a cultural level, I understood that we were rooting for each other. You know, like we absolutely had each other's back. And the majority of us had that fish out of water mentality, but we were doing it together, you know?
Right. But it's also the cool thing about that is it's kind of this unspoken, it's just camaraderie. We just know.
Yeah.
Like, it's just there. Like, it's not even something that needs to be discussed. Like, listen, you got my back.
No.
It's just natural to look out for one another, you know?
Yep. And real talk, you were justified to be concerned about going on that Southern tour.
Let's just talk
because
about
that was a trip.
Okay, let's talk about that for a minute. Some of the some of the stuff we've seen on tour. I don't know if you remember this, Siri, but that one time I can't remember what town we were in, but it was like a bar / I don't know restaurant.
We were in Marksville
when we came in. It was there was like a
Marksville, Louisiana.
Yes,
and there I know was exactly.
Some song on the jukebox that was being played that definitely was not like a welcoming song for us coming in. Like, it was so like awkward. And I remember walking in and it was like the record skip. Like people just, it was so like, again, it's one of those moments that's like, if I was there alone, I don't even
absolutely
know what
not.
I would have done, but just to know that you were in this experience with me. And it, again, it was just such different, just a different life. Like, I remember one of my homestays telling me, you know, that they had, that her daughter was going to Black prom. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, come again? She's like, my daughter's doing the Black prom. And I'm like, oh, the all Black you wear? She's like, no, like Black folks, Black people prom. And I'm like, what? I could not, Siri, my mind was like, I couldn't believe it. Like, the whites had their own prom and then the folks had their own prom. And it was just such a different kind of, again, way of being that was so outside of my norm that, again, I, you know, if thinking back, you know, just looking back, it would have been good and nice to just have a little bit of a history, you know, just to work through some of this stuff. Cause a lot of it, I think, came out for me while I was there too, because I was just seeing so much for the first time.
Right. Right. Everything was, it was a lot of newness all at once.
All at once. And then, you know,
I mean, there was on a tour bus, you know what I'm saying? Different backgrounds, different religions, different political beliefs.
Yes. There's so
And then
much.
Going to places that are different than even where we grew up.
Right. Right. So it's like, we need to talk about this. Like, this is, this is a lot. And then also, you know, you're staying with homestays. What are their values? What do they think? You know, what, so who are these people we're staying with too? You know, so there was just a lot, because I've heard different conversations, different things, different topics have come out with just sitting and staying with homestays. I've learned a lot and have talked about a lot of stuff. But again, it was a lot to take on. It was a lot.
Do you remember how much we would request to homestay together just so we could... And like looking back, I can absolutely think that people are like, them bitches always want to stay together, just best friends. They just want it. But it was, I felt so much safety and comfort in being able to have to navigate those experiences if I got to do it with you. And often we were in places who didn't even have Black health and beauty supplies. So like,
okay.
We'd have to ration share.
Do you remember when you would have to travel? I think it was the South. It was somewhere we went, but we brought our own box perm.
Yes! Oh my God. This is before either one of us had natural, just let our hair natural. See, this is what ages us. Before we went natural. And like, it was like, well, save me half because my edges is
now, people. We're totally natural now, but back then, it was a different day.
And like, what about the color of tights? Do you remember the toast, burnt toast tights?
You were screwed if you did not pack your stuff before you left. There was no let me run to Duane Reade or CVS.
No!
There was none of that. Like, if you didn't bring your stuff, you better hope there's someone else, your complexion.
It was a wrap. You're calling home hoping somebody will send you something.
It was a wrap. But I hear you. You know, because sometimes I laugh about when I think about, you know, just let's be real, Sarah. You know, the antics we pulled. There was definitely some antics that we pulled back in the day.
Hold on. So for our listeners, Cleo and I have not always been. Hold on.
Okay, you.
Cleo and I have not always been so reserved as we are today. And like this, might have to be a whole ass another episode to talk about.
You're right.
All of our pranks and.
I think you're right. But this is the last thing I'll say about this, is because sometimes I think about that one homestay that we had. Where were
Which
we?
One?
Say Germany, maybe.
Oh my gosh, with the race car bed.
Oh my gosh. But I was really uncomfortable with the homestay that I stayed with. Like, really, really uncomfortable. But I just remember us, you know, and maybe we shouldn't have done it. Yes, we definitely talked to your homestay and said that we had spoken to, I don't remember who, whoever the company manager was, and they gave us permission to homestay together, that I could leave my current homestay and stay with you. Like, we totally made that stuff up. But at the same time, when I look back, it really makes sense, because again, I was so uncomfortable in being in that space by myself and knowing like, at least, okay, our homestays are friends. Let me just try to get and stay where Siri is. It was kind of a survival. Yeah. Truly, because it was just
so many things were out of fear for me and the need to feel like I had to survive, you know?
Yeah. Like, do you remember?
Because we had some weird racial stuff while we were in Germany.
Like, someone even called us the N-word. Like, oh, those N-words over there. Look at that.
Yes. You know, like, it was all willy-nilly.
All casual, you know?
Yes.
It's those kinds of things that really, in some ways, I didn't even deal with that in living in an all-white community sometimes. Like, some of that stuff was not even stuff I'd experience in my direct circle.
Me neither. That was the first. I had so many firsts when it comes to racist commentary, typecasting, body positivity, lack thereof, you know, all of it was first for me. And I was like, dang, is this what the real world is like? You know?
Shoot.
It was a lot of firsts. I had a hard, man, I took it really hard the first time we weren't cast together.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, yeah. I thought I was not going to be able to be happy or thrive. And I might have been a tad codependent, because I was almost not willing to experience things unless you were coming too.
Sure.
You know? And if you weren't there to have my back, then who was gonna?
No, absolutely. It's a scary thing. Because the thing is, too, you're going out into the world. it's not like we were just staying in Southern California. You're going out to right. these different places. These places.
We're in New Zealand. We're in Germany. Right. We're all over the States. We're in England. We're in Scotland. We're every freaking where.
And I got to count on the people I'm with. Let me tell you, I got to, because that's all I have. So if I can't, yep. if I don't feel that you got my back in that way, what am I going to do? I'm thousands of miles away from home. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It is so important. And that's something I've definitely, I've really grown from that. Like that experience yeah. has taught me so much in terms of thinking forward and, you know, going into, you know, my world of like music therapy and world of just working with people through music is making sure that there's representation and that there's support and that people feel that their needs are being met. That's super important.
That is so important. So Cleo, yeah. What inspired you to explore the path of music therapy?
Oh my gosh. So believe it or not, I got a magazine. It was another one of those, God just has like divine intervention. The timing is always perfect. The intervention timing is always perfect. It was, again, I was in Young Americans for a few years at this point, loved it. Thank you for the experience, but I knew it was time to move on. Like it was definitely like, yeah. what else is there? I'm itching. It's the same way I felt in high school. Like, I'm ready to break out. But you know, you kind of got to spread your wings and you gotta move when the spirit says move. So anyway, I got a magazine right on time that came through. And I just remember seeing those two words together on the cover. There was a white gentleman in a white lab coat, sort of thing. And I just saw the two words music therapy. I had never heard those two words put together before, but there was something about mm-hmm. seeing those words together that just spoke to me. Like it made sense. I was like, mm-hmm. music, yes. Therapy, yes. That to me, that means naturally that's bringing, you know, using music as a positive way to make change or to heal or to, you know, to improve. So it made sense to me. And I read the article and it was a magazine from Berklee College of Music. And I just knew then. I didn't need to know anymore. I read the article. I was totally convinced. Also, having had the experience in the Young Americans and working in these schools with these kids and seeing the power of music firsthand, like there was no doubt about that. That to me was very clear, was seeing how powerful music can be and how folks, you know, from different walks of life can really, how much positive change and how much work we can do together when we are in the same mindset, when we are speaking the same language, when we're in it together. So that was something that was really had an impact on me. One of the biggest takeaways for me in the group was the power of music and how it really brings us together, how it comes to our community, that it's a positive experience and we're able to accomplish way more together than we are separate. You know, so that to me was there was no question about that because I was seeing it firsthand. I really was seeing the power of music.
Right.
So that wasn't lost mm-hmm. on me. And so when I was done with the Young Americans, I knew that there was still that was very true. So the idea of music and therapy together made complete sense to me. You know, it resonated mm-hmm. fully. And so after reading the article and just seeing how music was being used in various populations and really helping improve quality of life and you know, giving voice to the people who need a voice, you know, need a place to express, just the positive elements of music making and how it is such a integral part. It's such an innate thing. You know, we are musical beings. Mm-hmm. I really don't separate the two. You know, I think that we live in a society now where it's so much more, we have become it's the professionals versus the amateurs, or I can't do this.
Right.
You know, so there's this weird, in my opinion, a very unhealthy relationship to what music is and that we truly are music. Like, I mean, you're born with a heartbeat.
Absolutely.
That is rhythm. That is music.
I think music is like the vessel beyond food that connects every single culture.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and so for it to be a regular part of everybody's day seems like the best therapy and thing you can do for yourself or your community is share that in some
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And exactly. And it connects us to each other. But when you know, for me, it was really great again, because even after the Young Americans, I traveled as a music therapist, as a student, actually, at this point, you know, traveling to other countries. And I spent time in Kenya and I worked at a couple orphanages out there. And I really struggled because I wasn't mm-hmm. sure I mean, let's be real. Like, I'm grateful for the field of music therapy and what the field of music therapy offers and how long it's been around and how it's really been able to change lives for the better through music therapy. But I struggled going to a country mm-hmm. and saying we're going to do music therapy when, I mean, they've been doing music therapy before we ever had a name for it. Like, that's truly, you right. know, it's kind of like a, you know, and also that savior mentality too. Offer you this and we're yeah. gonna do this. I struggled with that for a bit. But what mm-hmm. I learned there when I was there was they had so much to teach us. I learned so much yeah. in working with these kids, young folks, you know, teaching us about their music. It was much mm-hmm. more of an exchange. And I think that's where, again, we get places in life is where I can respect your culture and what you have to offer me. And I'll respect what you yeah. have to offer me as well. If I feel heard and you feel heard, then we'll feel good. We'll be good in this. You know what I mean? And so that's what the experience mm-hmm. truly was for me. And I remember working with some kids doing songwriting activities and whatnot. And I remember this one particular person who was on tour with us, or not tour, wow, was on this trip with us. And I remember this little girl asking him to sing her a song. I think she couldn't have been more than like 6 or 7. And she asked him to sing and he's like, oh, you know, actually I'm a horn player. I'm a saxophone player. I don't sing. And her face, I mean, it said it all. Like, she was so confused because she couldn't understand. Like, I don't sing. Like, she's like, you speak.
Everybody sings,
you
speak, right?
You are music. And that's what she said. She's like, I don't, it made no sense to her to say, I don't do this. I can do this, but I can't do this. And it really changed right. my approach as a music therapist too. And just how I approach music and how I work with people who feel that way. Like, I'm not a singer, so I can't do this. Yeah. Nonverbal, so I can't do this. You know, mm-hmm. so I think it's really about how do we work with people? How do we meet people where they are? And I think this is what music therapy has been in my practice and has taught me so much, is you really learn to see people and to meet them where they are without your agenda just being, you're going to bump, 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 bump. But like,
yeah. And then apply it to every portion of your life and every human you meet.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, how much, you know, how much richer of experiences overall would we be having? How many more these sorts of wars and disagreements could we resolve yeah. if we would just hear each other, if mm-hmm. people felt heard and everyone had a seat at the table and yeah. a space to express and for us to hear that? Because that's the thing that we're lacking is perspectives. We all, you know, it's I feel like that's where, again, sometimes things are backwards in this country is, you know, these people know this answer, these people, but we're not really asking all the voices to be represented. Right. And I feel like that's the same thing in the art of music therapy, is that it's taught me to go deeper, deeper and to meet people where they are. Being working for my practice and the work that I do, there's one person in particular that I'm thinking about, but I can think of a number of these individuals and clients that I've worked with, but some of my best teachers in this work have been the nonverbal folks that I have worked with and served.
Truly. I can imagine, for sure, for sure. You have to explore different ways to communicate and listen. Absolutely. And share.
Absolutely. And my agenda is no longer riding shotgun. Like, I can't yep. like, just say you're going to do that. I have to find other ways and I have to meet you where you are. Like, there is no, yep. there's no relationship if I can't do that. Like, I can't, mm-hmm. there's no connection and there's no rapport. There's no trust. If, yeah. if you don't feel heard, why would you trust me? Like, there's nothing mm-hmm. to trust. There's no relationship. So that has really taught me, and you know, and I supervised a number of students from Berkeley as well. Mm-hmm. When I was running the music therapy program, I was directing the program at the Community Music Center of Boston, where families were coming week after week and seeing me for one-on-ones. And I also did group music therapy, but it was really about teaching these students too about how yeah. to learn. We think we know how to listen, but we really don't until you're working with somebody that you really have no choice but to listen to, like,
yeah.
figure things out. Like, mm-hmm. these are the moments where you really learn that, like, to get your stuff out of the way, put that to the side, and really be present for this person sitting across from you. And yeah. so that's what I have loved about this work. I think another thing that I love is really you're thinking about a lot of some of these, sadly, a lot of marginalized individuals and mm-hmm. communities. And there's a lot of incredible work in working with some of these special needs communities, these individuals who really have so much to offer and so much to say and so much to teach us, truly. You know, working with disabled communities has really been such a, it's a highlight for me. I wouldn't change any of it for the world, because it's really just taught me so much, again, about being with people. Being with people and learning how to, again, work together. And again, how good it feels when you feel heard and you're given the space to express. Because that's what everybody wants. Everybody wants to be heard. Everyone wants to be respected. Everybody wants to be loved. Mm-hmm. And if you're still enough, you can understand. You can really hear where people are coming from. So anyway, that's a long story. Yeah, anyway.
I'm still listening.
You know, that's the work. That's the beauty of the work. And that's what I've been able to take from that. And, you know, working with these groups for long periods of time, you just see their growth. You see how far they've come. You see the confidence coming in. You see the freedom of expression and just to know, you know, because music is such a powerful tool, and you're really promoting growth and life skills through the use of music. And again, I think we've become such a society that is so, we're music consumers and we're not music makers anymore.
Right.
You know, we buy our music and we want it from here, and let me get this and let me get, but we've kind of fallen away from that, you know, that let's make it. Like, there was a time we really sat around the piano after dinner and made music. There was a time when
I would just sit around and see whatever random harmonies we could come up with. Like, that was fun for us in our off time. You know,
you just think about our history, you know, and you think about Black folks and the importance and the power of music and what role that is played in their lives and the importance of that. It's really, it's sad, because I just feel like as I've gotten, as I've worked with more communities and teaching classes and whatnot, and just seeing how disconnected people are to the idea and the concept of making music. And, you know, and also I've learned a lot too, that people, you know, again, the power of words, because I cannot tell you the amount of families or parents I've run into that say things to me. These are people well into their 50s and 60s that, you know, we're in a music class together and I'm trying to get them to sing. And they're like, oh, I don't sing because, you know, when I was in second grade, I was told I was tone deaf and I've never sung. And it's a real thing. Like, people are.
Yep, I just had a conversation with the things, and she said, oh, she likes to, and she kind of sing in the choir every once in a while, but she's not confident. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm happy to give you voice lessons if you want any coaching, even if it's just so you feel better while you're singing in the shower. And she was just like, thanks, but no thanks. I just don't sing.
Yeah, so that, mm-hmm. so you know, exactly. There people are in pain. And to me, again, when you think about the Black experience and you think about the power of music and what music was for us, it was survival. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It really was a way of expressing. Sometimes there's no words you can speak for some of the anguish and the pain and the stuff you're going through. Like, you just gotta wail. I saw the best t-shirt the other day. I think I might have told you this before, Siri, if not, but it said, you know, they want our rhythm but they don't want our blues. It's true.
Yes.
You know, it's, man, it really is. It is such a, some of this stuff when I hear singer, like when you're singing from a place of truth and authenticity, it's a visceral, it's a gut reaction. I really believe that music is it plays that role in our lives. It is, like you said, survival. Outside of food, it's the top things. It's food, oxygen, water. Yep. It's all of that. Music. Music should be right up there with it, because it really, I truly empathize and feel for people who don't feel they can utilize their voice.
Yeah, I agree. Go ahead.
No, just to not, to me, I that feels super claustrophobic to me. The idea I've got this, you know, that I can't just let it rip, you know, it's like a good cry. It's a good, you know, you just gotta, how do you keep that inside of you? And you don't let that out, you know? So it makes you wonder what else is off, if, you know, cause it all flows. And if you're suppressing that, I feel like other things can actually be affected.
Oh, yeah. How did you get involved in folk music?
Ah, folk music. You know, I think I was I have been connected to folk music since, again, early childhood, truly, because of a lot of the old traditional folk songs that my parents play, Haitian folk songs that their parents taught them, my great-grandparents, songs that they have been singing for generations that have survived, that have shifted and changed a little bit. But at the same time, too, as you know, when I met my husband, I love him. He just walked out.
Wait, how did you guys meet? I don't even know how you met, I don't think.
Oh my gosh, Siri. Oh gosh, this needs to be like a 2-hour podcast with these questions.
We can talk as long as we want. It's mine.
Long story short, we met about 3 years ago on Labor Day weekend. I came out here to visit one of my close friends from Berkeley who lives in Brooklyn as well. She had met Dan a few months prior. She knew that he was, you know, does music for all ages music for kids and families. And she knew, of course, that I was doing, you know, early childhood music. And
Yes, please tell the class though. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And so she was like, oh my goodness, you two need to meet. You guys would hit it off. She really wasn't trying to be matchmaker, but you know, again, with just our work and our careers, she just knew we would really hit it off. So we met each other that weekend. The rest was history. I mean, you know, there's of course little things here and there, little pieces, but it was just a match made in heaven. It was just a natural connection. We ended up, and that's how I met my husband. Truly, I met him by way of music. I came to the house.
Yeah.
We sat around the table and we had instruments and we had the three of us and we harmonized and sang for about maybe 6 or 7 hours, but it truly felt like maybe 20 minutes. Like it was that natural and that like goosebumpy and like tingling and like where you just know it's right. You know that, you know when you hear that harmony chord and you're, you know, the hairs on the back of your neck, you're just like, yes, you just want to dig your nails into the seat you're sitting on. It was like that. It was like, oh my gosh, this is tasty. This is delicious.
Delicious.
We love
exactly.
We love the way they sound. And so then and there, we decided to make a trio. And we've been, yesterday we had a show here in Brooklyn. So we've been 3 years later and we're still performing together, the three of us. But my husband and I do a lot of duo stuff together. So a lot of, we do a lot of folk music. And also because folk tradition really is, again, about that sort of bringing people together. You know, it is a natural way of just saying, let's all sing together, let's all harmonize together, or not, let's just, you know, use our voices together, you know. And so a lot of these folk songs have very you know, the good hookable sort of melodies that just feel good to sing, you know. And it's cool to keep these traditions alive, you know. It's the people's music, that's what folk is. And so we love to do that because we understand the importance of knowing one's tradition and one's culture, and also the importance of sharing that and the importance of not letting these things die off. So that's, you know, that's the work we have been doing together is really singing and inspiring kids to really make their own music, families, people to make their own music. And I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. I feel really privileged as an artist, because I feel like naturally, although I'm not practicing music therapy in say the traditional sense anymore, you know, not necessarily working with clients in that direct kind of way, I still feel I'm drawing from that tool belt all the time when it comes to performances and working in public spaces with people. In a way, I'm able to reach more people than ever before. But the importance of, you know, you can do this. Like, this isn't, there is no fourth wall here. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't, we're here and you're there. So the work that Dan and I do, you know, it's so beautiful just knowing his history and just what he has done for music for young folks, you know, for kids and families is really profound.
So we were talking about you and Dan making music, and I'd love for you to share a bit more about the type of music you do, because I know it's family friendly, it's social music intended for everybody. So could you explain, you know, what that means for people who aren't familiar with you guys' work?
Sure. So yeah, you hit it on the head. It's social music. It's the people's music. We really love to create a sound that is sort of handmade. We don't necessarily go for a super polished look, because we really think it's important that people can be inspired by it and know that, you don't need a whole lot to make your own music. So, you know, it's really about finding ways to bring people into the musical experience. We realize that, you know, not everyone just sings along. Not everyone has the ability to sing along. So the more entry points you can have into a musical experience, the more inclusive the experience is. So, the work we have been doing lately has really been focused on sensory friendly experiences through music. We were actually commissioned by the Kennedy Center back in 2017 to create the very first, I can say, this is the world's very first sensory friendly comic folk opera.
Oh my God. And I respond like I didn't already know. It's just so good.
It really is so good, Seer. Like, it's definitely one of the proudest things I've ever been a part of. The Kennedy Center in and of itself is such an amazing, amazing, amazing institution. The work that they do, they really have written the guidelines for sensory friendly. That's kind of how we've been connected to them. They do a lot of work when it comes to accessibility and inclusivity. And they're thinking about a lot of these things, not just the musical experiences themselves, but also just thinking about how people get into the building. How do we really prep people for this experience? And so to work with these greats, like, we worked with a lot of their educators and professionals in the world of disabilities. And so really putting together this show was a dream, truly a dream, because, you know, it debuted there, premiered at the Kennedy Center, then we've been touring it, but it really has all of those points that I talked about. You know, there's something to do on every song. It's very invitational. It's very inclusive. The entire performance, it's not just us performing for you and you just clap at the end. It really is come as you are. That's our big thing. We really believe in opening the door wider, you know, so creating the conditions so people with children that might have disabilities can feel very comfortable in these spaces, because as a music therapist, as performers, we find that all the time is a big challenge. Right. That families feel, listen, I love music and I know my child loves music, but we don't feel comfortable walking into these spaces because sometimes there's judgment. We're shushed, or my child's looked at in a nasty way and I don't want to expose my child to that. And what parent wants to, you know? So I think, And so it's really about teaching tolerance, and it's really about educating people and the neurodiversity and neurodiversity audience, all of us, you know, how do we come together and how do we respect how one responds to music? Because the truth is, we know there's no one way to be in music, and everyone
or
has
anything, right?
Or anything for that matter, truly. Like, it's okay. Like, one song that might make someone bawl might make somebody like smile. You know, it really is, you know, so once you can respect that and know that there's not, because that's the other thing I struggle with in a lot of theater culture too, is you realize, I think theaters are doing things, are times are changing, which is really great because we're seeing this shift. And I think that people are becoming more in tune to accessibility and inclusivity as a whole. But I think that, you know, we look at a lot of these structures that we are a part of. When you think about going to the theater and you think about having these experiences, and it's a culture. Like, there's definitely a culture to that, and it's very old school, and it's very, I'm not saying that, listen, you can't have your space for these kinds of things, but I think we have to be really mindful that the world is changing and that there are people. We need to be able to allow as many people to come into the experiences as possible. There's no one way to be. And what I was finding was, like, you know, sometimes it shows we are expected to clap at the end of the piece. You stay in your seat. You don't da-da-da. Mm-hmm. You don't talk. You can't open your cough drop wrapper because you'll be, cussed out by the, you know, there's a lot of like Dan and I had that experience ourselves. Like, we went to see a show and here we are, two able-bodied people, Black playwright Lynette Nottage, who's doing this show Meeting Vera, and we're there, it's a packed house, and we're in the middle of the I cannot tell, it was such an eye-opening experience. So we're sitting there and this man sitting behind me is whispering to his wife, like, I mean, he's irate. This man is frustrated about something, but I'm talking to Dan and I can hear him going off about something, but I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about, but you could tell he's frustrated. So I'm talking to Dan, but I kind of have one ear towards Dan, but I'm kind of listening to this man behind me. So he's going off about, did I can't believe, da 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 da. And then all of a sudden I realize he's talking about us. And he's just like, you know, he says, no, Siri, I kid you not. He's like, I can't believe, like, of course. Okay, so mind you, let me tell you what I'm.
Of course.
He has the nerve. He's like, of course we'd get sat behind the two tallest people in all of New York. And I'm like, this man can't be talking to me because I'm definitely 5'3". Like, that's definitely.
I mean, on a tall day.
So I'm like, wait. So he's upset. He's irate. So I turn around and I'm like, I'm sorry, sir. He's like, I'm like, is there a problem? And he's like, well, I can't believe. I mean, do you really have to wear that hat? And I'm like, I'm sorry. Excuse me. And he's going off. He wants me to take off my hat. He wants me to do this, do that. Because he's upset because I'm too tall, apparently. I'm dying, Siri. Of course, the hat stays. But then it continued during the show. A woman up, you know, two row in front of me was opening a cough drop or a wrapper. I don't know, something. This man made such a fuss. And it's like, this is very rude. And I cannot enjoy the show with you doing this. And it just makes me realize this is just opening a wrapper. Because, right. Again, true. And also because you've never opened a bag of chips at home and heard a bag open. So I'm just like, is this serious?
Right.
He's like, I can't do this. I can't concentrate with you. And I'm dying, like, wait. Okay, so anyway, but this is the thing, and this is, again, about a rapper. So imagine the child who is vocalizing. Like, for that parent. You know what I'm saying? So,
right.
There really needs to be a change in terms of how we experience these things, because we got to be in it together. You know, and that's the other thing about Dan and my work is we are, sensory friendly means different things to different folks. Sometimes it's specifically for children on the autism spectrum, you know, with autism spectrum disorder. Then, folks with sensory issues and challenges, it really can mean different things. But for Dan and I, we really look at it as a space for all to come. We don't necessarily do shows that are just for children with autism spectrum disorder or just these other kids. It really is, we really encourage and try to create conditions where everybody can come together. And I think that the work that we do, go ahead.
And you're doing it and you're succeeding. Aww. Because I've been to your shows. I brought my kid to your shows and every time, and spectrum or anything like that, but I can invite his friends who are, and I know that we can go to something all together and all jive and it's all gravy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a fantastic educational experience, but it's a party, you know.
Yeah, well, and it's good because parents can just enjoy, because I feel like that's always been a challenge too, is like where parents feel like, I gotta watch my kid, I gotta make sure he doesn't run, I gotta make sure he doesn't jump,
right.
I gotta make sure he stays seated, I got, you know, so it's so yeah. much, and it's like, no, but you're taking even that parent out of the experience, and then what fun is that for the kid, too, when it's so much restricted?
Right.
So it's kind of like, you know, just really, and I think that Dan and I, the work that we do naturally lends itself to that sort of approach, so it's not like we're changing our show to be sensory friendly in a way to, like, okay, we got it. Our show naturally kind of lends itself to those
it's
elements.
It's just that way.
Yeah, because it really is that way, because it's inclusive. It's sing along. It's come as you are. There's moments for, you know, for dancing. If you want to dance the whole time, you're welcome to. You're welcome to clap. So we kind of articulate that in the beginning. We make it known. We also just help people understand that this is the day and age in which we live, and we need to demonstrate, you know, tolerance. We need to really be able to experience these things. We're all in this together, and the more that
Absolutely.
I can see you, you'll see me, and I'll feel heard, and you'll feel heard, and we can do things together. You know what I mean? But the minute it's a them versus us, and it really kills the whole experience. So we really try to create those conditions. And so the sensory friendly folk opera, you know, it's really been well received, and it's a lot of fun. And we love doing it because, again, our audience is so diverse. And that's my dream, because I really believe in representation on the stage. And I think that when Dan and I do shows together, just the visual of Dan and I speaks such volumes, volume to people. Like, it really is such a positive thing for kids to see, even if we don't. But I think it's really important for kids to see what love looks like, and that love doesn't necessarily have to. Kids that come to our shows too, it's hard to be what you can't see. And if you don't have representation, and if you don't see yourself represented in various platforms throughout life and other careers, it's hard to imagine what that you could be that. You know, and I remember me growing up in school, I didn't see that. I really didn't see a lot of that sort of, I didn't see me on the stage. I didn't. I didn't see when they had teachers paying people to come in to come do things with us. It wasn't people who looked like me. So I think that Dan, positive message, and not just to Black and brown kids, but I think to just kids and families as well, just to know that this is the world we want to live in, and what a beautiful world it is when we can accept each other and love each other as we come.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So now Dan and I, we worked on a songbook at the start of, we've been working on the songbook for a minute, but I think it was released just around January of 2019, end of December. That's what it was. December, and it's an awesome book series. So this
tell us the title. Tell us the title. I got my copy.
It's called Dan Zane's House Party, A Family Roots Music Treasury. And so we were approached by a publishing company some time ago, and we were super excited to be able to put a songbook out into the world that represented the kinds of music we love to sing. And so we kind of had freedom to put whatever songs we wanted to in this book. And so we thought about a lot of these songs that Dan has recorded over the years. Various people, a lot of collaboration. So it's a songbook of comprised of 64 songs from near and far. Folk songs from all over. I mean, you got Puerto Rico, you got Haiti, you've got Jamaica. I believe you got Scotland. It's from all over. Really, really great songbook that has notation in it. It's got references. There's reading references to give you, there's essays for each section, so you know about each song, where it came from, the origins of the songs, and also listening suggestions as well to hear various versions of these songs, and reading excerpts as well. So recommended reading. But then there's also, again, the notation piece, but there's guitar, ukulele, mandolin chords in the back as well. It's so good. It really is. A lot of friends, a lot of educators have bought this book. I think this is an ideal book for any family. Truly, it needs to just be on your library, your stand, your book stand. Like, it really has got to be there on your bookshelf, because it's such a, it's not just a songbook. I know we call it a songbook to me, but it's so much more than just a songbook, because, again, there's so much content in there.
Yeah.
And if for any history buff, they would love that. I think this is an ideal gift for teachers too. They would use that in the classroom. Music therapists could really benefit from this. I think also homeschool teachers, you know, moms and dads. And,
yes, you know, kids. I'm telling everybody about it.
Truly. But it's a starting point, because I find that, again, a lot of folks are like, I don't want to just sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Like, I want other music, and I want. Sort of typical songs you might hear all the time.
Right.
You know, so there's some good Jamaican folk songs in there. There's this one song called Daniel in the Den that I love. And all of these songs are on all of your social media platforms. So you could actually get the songbook and then listen to the songs, because I know people struggle with that too. They're like, okay, I like this song's title sounds good, but I don't know how it goes. So you could actually listen to the song on, Apple Music, YouTube, Spotify, whatever, and hear how the songs go and make your own music with your family. So, Korean folk songs, Haitian folk songs, American folk songs. And it's a really, really great book. And that's another project that Dan and I worked on that just brought my heart such joy.
So will you tell me a little bit about the Jamaican song you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. So there's this Jamaican folk song called Go Down Emmanuel Road, which is amazing. It's so fun. It's got these really wonderful melodies and this sort of call and response piece in it. And again, like I said, you know, families have been sending us little video clips of them doing some of these songs, and it is the sweetest thing. Because you see them working in this book together, little one on egg shakers, this one playing this instrument. So it's truly bringing people together, and that's what we really need to be seeing today. It's no way around that. We need to be making music together.
Nope.
You know? And so I think again this book really serves that. It you know, there's something in it for everybody. With the chords in the back too, if you're learning an instrument, you can certainly make your way through the book. The chord changes are pretty simple because again, these are basic folk songs, but you can add complexity with harmonies and whatever you'd like to add to it. But it's a great book through and through.
It's amazing.
Thank you, love. Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, I find so many art forms to be connected in ways one might not immediately recognize. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I've been able to find a common connection between, you know, people, humanity, through music and agriculture. Like, that's my jam, gardening mm-hmm. and music. And now, listen, I don't even know if you know this, okay, but you were one of the first persons to encourage me to make my own bath and body products and start, like, doing natural
no
things,
way!
Like, instead of... Yes, like 100 years ago, you sent me a care package with African black soap and shea butter in it.
Right. Oh my God.
Yeah, that was like the catalyst that sparked my commitment to living a more natural life, a more holistic life.
It was my heart.
Yeah, to like really dig into like, okay, what is essential to my life? And that was music, and that was dirt and do things naturally. And I'm like, well, shit, one of my best friends is like just encouraging me to just live my damn life, you know? So like, and all you were trying to do was send me some soap and keep me from being ashy.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
So like, yeah, for real, friend. Like, I love seeing this journey of you incorporating all your talents into your life's work. Like, your book is amazing. The work you and Dan do together is amazing. The work you're doing on your own is amazing. And I honestly, when you told me that you were launching your soap business, mm-hmm. I was like, that makes more sense than anything I've ever heard, because you already ooze creativity and you work with so many different art forms. So I just kind of feel like, well, of course you would want to expand that in a way to continue connecting with other people beyond just music, because this is such a natural thing too, you know, like, not to get off music, but I'm trying to talk about yourself. Delicious.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, you are so inspiring in ways you don't even know.
You are speaking my language and you get it. It's
were
so
you,
nice
were you,
to talk,
you talk
to
about
you just
yourself?
Don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
I love that. Oh my gosh, Siri. Well, I am just so flattered and honored. I cannot believe that package 100 years ago really changed
yeah.
my life in such a way. I totally remember that though. And
yeah,
you're right. You know, so I have, so making skin products. So I kind of started dabbling in, you know, making my own sort of like whipped body butters and lotion bars and chapsticks, natural products, maybe close to about 7 years ago, mm-hmm. 5, 6, 7 years ago. And I really did it because I was interested in, I have spent, so most of my life has been spent focusing a lot on, you know, food I put in my body, you know, a lot of dieting, a lot of yo-yo dieting, a lot of just conscientiousness of like, trying to lose weight, trying to maintain weight, trying to just a lot around food and like trying to take care of my temple and fuel it with good things. And mm-hmm. I think I was so consumed with what I was putting in my body that I kind of neglected the on my body kind of thing.
Yeah, and the biggest organ on the body is the skin.
The biggest organ, you know? And I realized the more research I was doing, you know, that our skin absorbs, you know, nearly 60% of everything we put on it. And that's that's a lot, you know? And so it really got me thinking and looking at labels. I was like, I'm so used to reading labels for food, but never had I really taken a minute to read the labels of the products I was putting on my body.
Right.
And so I started just kind of doing a lot of DIY, and Pinterest was my best friend, and looking things up and finding basic recipes that were easy enough for me to do and to make. And so I started making skincare products, lotions, and I would reach out to friends and I would send them things. I would send their kids things. I just wanted to share this amazing thing that I felt like was so good for me with the people I cared about. So I started doing that. And then when I really got serious into I kind of upped my game, and I got into soap making, and that was right when I moved to New York, coming up on 2 years. So actually just under 2 years ago, I took a class out here in Brooklyn. I took a soap making class, and it forever changed my life. Honestly, it was like, mind blown, because I moved to this new state. It was overwhelming. I got engaged and I was moving in with Dan. And as I was moving my things into the house, I remember him looking at some of my products and he was like, babe, you ever look at how much plastic consumption you have? And like how much, I never really thought about it, Siri. Like he was like looking at your like beauty products and your stuff and your, you know, all my little things and this little jar and this little bottle and this little thing and my shampoo's got to be, you know, I had a lot of plastic. And just thinking again about, you know, our carbon footprint and like what I'm bringing. And then also the plastics, just being around a lot of plastic and what it's doing to our environment.
Absolutely.
Is something we really have to think about and something we really need to make big changes on, because I was bougie as all get out. I was like, no, I need my Bath and Body Works. I need like life without, what's that one called? Japanese blossom, cherry blossom, whatever.
Yes. Cucumber melon, baby. Cucumber melon.
Okay. Moonlit paths, all this stuff.
Yes.
Like I cannot exist without my stuff. Like this is like just what I do. Like you just got to understand. And then, you know, but as I was looking at this, I was like, this makes absolutely no sense. Because I was like, oh, no, I love the lather of the bubbles and the this and the that. But then as you're reading these ingredients again, you know, you're looking and it's like, what is this? So what does this do? How do you pronounce? You know, it was a lot of filler, a lot of stuff I couldn't pronounce, and a lot of stuff I frankly had no idea what it was. And I'm just graciously rubbing on my lady bits and everything else and doing all this, you know, going to town. And so I was like, you know, Dan's got a great point. And I was thinking about that. And so I took the soap making class. I've always wanted to get into soap making. I think I was a little terrified when it comes to working with lye. And I was just a little freaked out about it. But then being in a class with like a it made me feel more comfortable. I took the class and I made the most basic like orange and lavender or something, orange and lemongrass thing of soap, and I came home and I let it cure. And it's kind of like I imagine for you with gardening, you know, when you are, your hands are in that soil and you are, you know, you are in the earth and you are planting and you are nurturing and you are watering and you're watching and you see this thing grow, there's just such a level of pride and like my hands were a part of this, like I was bringing this into existence. And that's how I felt too. Like after I popped that bar of soap out and like took my first shower with this, I was like, this is amazing. Like I made this. Mm-hmm. And my skin felt better, Siri. Like my skin had been breaking out. I was having all kinds of reactions to my face, my body. And as I was, you know, I was using the soap, I was like, oh, right. Of course my skin would love this. There's everything I am using in this I could find in my pantry upstairs.
Right.
Like this is totally natural. So I'm like, I'm using essential oils. I'm using, you know, so all these natural things. And my body's like, woo, like my body's rejoicing. And so I was like, why am I, you know, that was it. And then also I looked at it and I'm like, a bar of soap is so much more intimate and special and unique than a bottle of whatever.
Right.
And I believe that, like, again, I believe it's, you know, I think that your shower time, your bath time is a very ritualistic time. It's personal time. It's me time. It's, and how do you create that environment for people? How do you create love and joy and listen, you are the bomb.com in a bar and give that to someone that they can bathe in, you know, with dignity and joy and feel good about what they're using during one of the most intimate parts of their day. So that's really what inspired me to eventually start my own business, because I was making a lot of this stuff, giving it to friends. And then after I was giving it to friends, a lot of friends were like, yo, this is really good. You
like,
need to,
like, so
I think
good.
You're one of them.
Because I immediately was like, wait, can you set an extra bar?
Exactly. You know, and so it's like, you should really, this is like dope. This is really good. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe. And so I started really taking it seriously and, you know, making my own recipes and special ingredients. And so part of, you know, my roots are in Haiti. Like, that's where my family is from. So all of the bars of soap that I make, I always am sure to include this Haitian ingredient that, my gosh, goes back to, I think, the mid-1600s in Haiti, that Haitians have been using this oil called l'huile masquetie, is how you say it in Creole, and it means it's Haitian castor oil, which is very different than just your general castor oil, but it is so emollient and rich, and it creates this incredible lather, but it's super moisturizing for your skin, and Haitians have been using it, again, for centuries when it comes to, I kid you not, l'huile masquetie was used for everything. You got a fever, l'huile masquetie. You want to wash your hair, l'huile masquetie. You know, it's just one of those things. It's like, you out of olive oil, l'huile masquetie. You know, so it's just kind of... It's just one of those oils that's like this, it's the sort of like a sacred oil of the island.
Yeah.
And it's so rare now. I remember as a kid when I'd go to Haiti, truly, we'd come back with bottles of this stuff. And any Haitian home you go to this day, any Haitian home you go to, they will always have a bottle of l'huile masquetie. Sometimes
that's
it's
amazing.
It's amazing. Sometimes it's in a Snapple bottle. Sometimes products, because again, it's a part of my culture, a part of my history, and I think it's important for that to be infused in the soap, but also because it's this sort of superstar ingredient, this power that is so good. Again, Haitians have been using it for generations for a reason. Again, like I was saying too, it's a little bit more rare. It's getting harder. I don't even think you can leave the island with boatloads like you did back in the day. But like, you know, we still get it. And I live in a predominantly Haitian community, so it's easy for me to get my hands on it. But like,
that is so cool. And the community get to your soaps.
Ooh, good question. Okay, so if you're interested in my soaps, I do have a Facebook page called Cleo Soaps. That's my nickname. So that's kind of how we came up with that name. Cleo Soaps on Facebook, and on Instagram, it's also Cleo Soaps. Or you can go to my new website. I'm so excited about this because it just launched, like, I don't know, 15 minutes ago, pretty much. But if you go to www.cleosoaps.com, you'll see my products there too. Right now I'm starting off with about 8 different kinds of bars, all naturally made. And they're amazing. So go check them out. Read a little bit about my story there. They're really, really great bars. And there's a lot of love and soul that have gone into every single bar that I've made.
I can attest they're the most delicious handmade soaps I've ever tried.
Oh, thank you, Siri. And Siri, before I forget too, because I didn't tell you, so for the house party songbook that Dan and I did, you can also get that at danzanes.com.
Or now we're talking.
There's some like Friday flash sale, extra discounted sale price on Amazon.com too. You can pick it up there as well.
Oh, wow. Now listen, if folks are going to go to Amazon, they should go ahead and leave a something. So like, you know what I mean? If you're going to...
Please.
Let the people know how fantastic this book is, because
Please.
People read those Amazon reviews, you know?
It's so true. And also, yeah, and if you do pick up a book, anybody who does pick up a book and you love the book, please, we'd love to hear from you. Leave a little review. It does help. Siri's absolutely right about that. Reviews really do help sell the product.
For sure. Thank you so much for this show.
Thank you for thinking of me. This was a lot of fun, even with all the stop and start. I'm so honored to be part of this series. And I just want to say too, I am so incredibly proud of you for starting this podcast. I think it's so important and very timely. And I think, again, also just thinking about the name in and of itself, kind of hippie, kind of hood, you know, I think it's just a testament to, we don't have to be just one way. And I love that about you, is that we're multifaceted, we're complicated. There's so many elements to who we are. We don't have to just be one way. And I think that the name says it all.
Thank you, friend. I love you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I love you. We'll talk soon.
Thank you guys so much for joining us today on Kinda Hippie, Kinda Hood. Please stay tuned for my next episode, which is going to be fantastic, with another dope co-host. Until next time, I'm Siri Larice.